Welcome to part two of my conversation with Dale Brunswald for The Liminalist, the podcast between.
That's working for me. What I respect, you just can't see. What you expect, I'll never be.
So, you know, I'm sorry, that really wasn't satisfactory, but it's just sort of a beginning. Do you have some pictures on initiation you want to share, please?
Not really. I mean, I was curious. Yeah, if you meant self-initiated or initiated by a secret society or so, but you went to the Ascended Master, so just stay on that. So do you believe that Steiner believed that he was initiated by human beings who are not ordinary human beings, however you want to put it? Is that what
it seems that he was fairly... Go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, I was just finishing the question. Is that what Steiner claimed?
I think he did, but never in a real public way. Those were mostly in esoteric lessons that he gave to groups of people. Mm. But he did talk about, and again, we'd really have to describe this person in detail, according to Steiner's picture of it, but the Master Jesus and Christian Rosenkreutz.
The Master.
And those two, shall we say, masters. Mm-hmm. So those two masters were, he regarded as maybe more, but those two in particular, he's mentioned that, he was in contact with whenever he needed to be.
Is that Jesus, JC, or is that a different Jesus?
So have you, here we are again, right? Have you ever read about his picture of the nature of the mystery of Golgotha?
No, I have read about the mystery. I've read Steiner on the mystery of Golgotha, but not the picture.
It's a wild ride. Tell me if you want me to stop and we'll talk about something else.
Well, but, yeah, but I want to stay just, on the,
go
I
ahead.
I want to stay on the
okay.
Sort of meta level here, because.
I'll say, no, it's not, Master Jesus is not what you think he is. Let's just say that for now. Mm-hmm. It is the Master Jesus, but it has to do with this incredible evolution of a Matthew Jesus boy and a Luke Jesus boy that eventually unite to become the Jesus of Nazareth, who was the reincarnation of Zarathustra, who then from 12 to 30 developed this organism that was not his body, but another body that he was the Luke gospel body, and which was a very special body. We'd have to go into the details Steiner gives on this, until at 30, because Zarathustra was the most developed initiate in the history of the world, he could voluntarily remove his own ego, his own incarnated self from that, and allow the being of the cosmic spiritual being called the Christ, who had been moving toward the earth for millennia, to now take hold of that physical, etheric, and astral bodies and become the Jesus Christ. That's the story.
Yeah.
And then out of that, a Master Jesus rises that is not the Christ, blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Right.
Tidbit.
The soul being consciousness that incarnated, I heard Steiner say is the sun, the consciousness of the sun.
Well, okay, for Steiner again, all the physical world that you and I see is an outer picture, right, of a spiritual reality. And so every star is a colony of spiritual beings living there. And for a time in his travels, the Christ lived as the sun being. We can't say space and time that he's one place or another place. So in a way, right, he was the great being of the sun, the Ahura Mazda, right? That Zarathustra talks about in that religion of 6,000 BC. And he was seeing that being approaching the earth, Steiner says. So in the religion of Ahura Mazda, you're seeing, he's perceiving and experiencing the beginnings after coming from the periphery of the cosmos and condensing for who knows how long till he's finally in the sun is his abode. Then now he begins to unite with the earth, which was the, shall we say that, you know, that was a destiny that happens then. And I wonder sometimes if it doesn't happen at other planets. You ever read Teilhard de Chardin?
No. Oh, okay. I know who you're talking about now.
He was a Jesuit.
Yeah, you pronounced it in a weird way, but yeah.
Add that in, because he thinks, oh, every planet, if humans approach it, reaches a fulfillment where he thinks the Christ unites with it, which is kind of a cool idea. I don't know if that's right? But I always thought it was kind of wild, you know? Anyway, I'm maybe talking too much.
Oh, it's definitely wild. I guess this is the crux of my struggle with this, and why I said that there's a point with Steiner where I just say, okay, I'm not going to go there. And it's not because I don't think any of this stuff is true. In fact, if I thought it was just made up, I don't know, I might be less wary of it. And it's, you know, I sum it up in the podcast with that riff I have about the angel that can be named is not the true angel, so don't try and summon it because you'll regret it. That these models that you're summing up,
good, nice. I like that word.
What model?
Yeah.
They're number one, they're hierarchical. So I have a problem with the hierarchical thing. And number two, and I think it's related. Well, before I go to number two, because it might seem condemnatory and I don't want to be, or judgmental, you must be well aware that beliefs of this kind, ascended masters and Christ avatars incarnating, and the New Age is full of them. We've got Ramtha, we've got Seth Speaks, we've got swaths of stuff that, in my opinion, researched opinion, is intelligence operation stuff, mind control, very dark, very destructive, manipulative, social cultural engineering, Ahrimanic, perhaps, definitely Luciferian. It deranges people. People who are walking around believing this stuff, they're half deranged. And I think it's a chicken or an egg thing. I mean, their derangement, their traumatizedness led them to the material because they were looking for crucial fictions, as I call them, to prop up their, you know, fractured, wounded ego. But also then that information or that knowledge, and I would say particularly if it's true, like Castaneda is an example of this, particularly if it has truth in it, is itself destabilizing for a number of reasons that we could get into, but we don't need to, I don't think, because I think you understand. I have a problem with these kinds of models for that very reason. I don't know what to do with them, really. They excite me. But then I say, well, no, but that's that kind of Luciferian, puffed up, sensual, orgasmic kind of spirituality is so much fun, isn't it? You know? So I'll bring it back to the hierarchy thing, because that's the other thing that, and you see, my point of comparison here is Dave O'Shana, like the time I spent with Dave O'Shana. That's why I wanted to talk about what you think Steiner is, initiate, clairvoyant. Is he enlightened is the question I have about Steiner, because Dave O'Shana calls himself enlightened, and he makes a very good case for it over the years that I've known him, for what he means by it. Over time, I've come to understand what he's talking about without yet fully experiencing it. And one of the surprising things about Dave's way of being, if it is enlightened or even if it isn't, but particularly if it is he doesn't seem to be very certain about anything, and he doesn't really work with concepts hardly at all. So I could ask him a relatively simple question along these kind of lines, you know, as in real cosmic stuff, and he'd just shrug and say, I don't know. And what I've learned, even though it's not necessarily true that he doesn't know, It's just like, well, you're not in a place where you would be able to understand the answers. But if he said that, that would be very pretentious and he'd seem like a master or something. And he's very careful, in my opinion, not to project any kind of master or to receive the projections of others onto him that he's a master. I think he is a master. He has incredible intuitive understanding about people's organs and things that are going on with them. And maybe and ancestors, he's able to communicate what people's ancestors are trying to communicate. So he seems to have clairvoyant abilities, but they're very under wraps. Like, there's no party tricks there. It's only when he's in a one-to-one and it goes deep enough that starts to come out. And I'm relating this to the hierarchical thing, like my reservation about hierarchy, that it seems to me that Dave, or this enlightened consciousness, because relating to how our consciousness is potentially infinite, that within the infinite, there can be no structures, there can be no hierarchy, because where would it end? There's no top, right? There's no top of an infinite hierarchy, so there's no bottom either. So it seems to me that the angels and the archangels and all that, you know, because I was deep into that stuff. I did the rituals and everything. And I can go right back there and I feel, yes, there's true resonance in it when I listen to you reading Steiner. But I also feel that it's an imposition of our own ego consciousness that we order something that is infinite and that doesn't have fixed structure, that is a continuum. It's everywhere and everything. And that we order, and then we create these matrices. And over thousands of years, they become reified and solidified and crystallized in the, I don't know, the Akasha, the astral, the ether, with these fortresses of thought that we put in tulpas and egregores, and, you know, there's all kinds of words for this. And so I don't want to, I don't know. I mean, what I see with Dave is he seems, at least what I sense the enlightenment is, really is freedom from all of that. So he's like angels, I don't know. Not because he's before having an experience of an angel, but because he's on the other side of it, maybe. As in, well, it's the mountains and mountains and then they're not mountains and that kind of thing that... if we open to an experience of transcendental possibilities, it can help to begin with to have these structured ideas and beliefs and models. But when we encounter the Christ or Lucifer or the angel, all that's just going to get blown away, and it's just not like that, is it? It's just, it can't be. This is just my opinion.
I think so too. Yeah.
I was going to say, this is just my opinion, but it's kind of like I feel I need to emphasize that because of how many people fall into these traps of the high concept and how much I have as well, you know. So this is my reservation, and also with the past lives thing, like I suppose it's like being a ninja or something, because I could say I don't believe in past lives, and it wouldn't be untrue if I just said that. And I would say that to some people. If they talk to me about past lives, I'd just say, boom, I don't believe in it. Look at it closely, you know. If you try and pick it apart, it doesn't really add up, because we've got the ancestors, we've got, you know, it can't be linear in that way. And yet, if somebody I have resonance with, we've just met, but I've listened to you talk a lot, so Phil is resonant, says, well, we're thousands of years old. All right, well, yes, okay. But I don't really know what that means. Like, I don't know what part of me has been around for thousands of years, you know. I honestly don't know. It could be my liver for all I know, right? I certainly don't think it's my ego in the way I use the word ego. Because that's the thing that gets inflated and goes crazy and causes all kinds of havoc. Anyway, so that's my counter spiel. I'll shut up now.
I'm not okay. Yeah, and I agree with all that. Really, all I have first of all, you had me on and we're talking, and I always try to communicate as best I can. And I'm going to say, apologize to everybody. I should have done that at the beginning, that a lot of my own thoughts sneak in there in a way that I hope doesn't distort Steiner for other people. Steiner never said to believe a word. In fact, we should talk about that word. Mm-hmm. I honestly, Jason, I don't know what it means. I don't know what the word belief means. Mm-hmm. I hope I have none. I mm-hmm. truly hope I have none of any kind. Mm-hmm. All I should have as a human being in our time are working hypotheses of everything. Okay. And I'm sure I fail. I'm sure there's some programmed internalized aspects of my psyche that I've just given up on it, habituated. And we could call those habituations beliefs. But in my conscious mind, if somebody confronted me with them, I go, I don't know if I know that. I don't know what you mean by I believe that. They'll go, well, look, you do this all the time. Oh, okay. I guess that's a kind of belief. Mm. Right. Mm. But I don't know what it means. I think it's an atavistic form of consciousness that still exists in us that isn't even healthy anymore. Hmm. Go ahead. That's my devil's advocate on that. What's your picture of belief? I'd really like to know, because I don't know what it means.
Yeah, that's I like that point. I've written and thought and talked about belief, and that because I've learned over the years how deceptive belief can be, I can't believe in my own beliefs anymore. But it doesn't mean I don't have them. So it's like being split in two.
Yeah.
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 And I think, but that's not like, you know, there's a thing in the occult circles, which is you just try on beliefs like clothes, and if they look good, yeah, you go out and you go to the party. Like, sorry, I think I froze up in mid-sentence there. Did you catch that?
No, I got it all. It's all fluid. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not that. I'm very skeptical of that kind of. I think that's cynical. The kind of thing, oh well, you know, I'll just adopt a belief and see if it works for me, and if I, you know.
Oh right. Yes.
It's not that. It's not that at all. It's just that there's a configuration of the mind that can't function without belief, and it can't not believe. It's just like thinking, you can't stop thinking, right? So I suppose I think this is getting close to the crux. It's this thing, this crucial fiction idea that my wife and I came up with, that the beliefs of mine that I particularly distrust are the ones that feel crucial. And the irony is that they're usually the closer to the truth, because that's why they mean so much to me, right? So Christ, wow. I mean, I said to an ex-Christian the other day, you know, I do believe that Christ was the Son of God. And he said, really? And once he said, really, I was like, well, actually, I don't know. Do I believe that? I just said it because of who I was with, right? But as soon as it came out as a sentence, and Charles Fort said this, I do not believe that the products of my mind should be subject to belief. As in, anything I can think with my mind, I'm not going to believe that. So I think that would be a much more succinct way of saying what I said previously. And Steiner addresses this. I mean, I used that excerpt at the beginning of the podcast that you read about words. The words are useless unless they're leading us to reality. And Dave is always talking about how the words are useless. And it's, of course, that infinity paradox. Well, he's saying that what I'm saying is meaningless and useless. But then, right, if he's saying that, it's not true. So, and something is happening through talking that can lead us to the real. And hey, kitty cat. I have a black cat, I see, but he's
21 years old.
21.
This is our 21-year-old cat. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting. I like what
no,
you're saying.
No,
this is Storm. Good.
Storm, eh? Beauty.
She had a sister, and we got him in a snowstorm. So we named one Snow, and we named one Storm.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Please continue. I'm sorry if I broke your thought there.
No, it was quite appropriate that you did. You know, I was heading there. So
we both struggle with this. Let's just say that too. We both struggle with this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kept looking and I keep looking right in the world. I still look and I look for the best story I can. I look for the story that somehow I go, why do I think that this makes more sense than anything else? Right? Yeah. Why do I think that? Well, one reason will be evidence. Some kind of evidence, right, that I get from the world. So what evidence do I get from Steiner? Well, I was a Waldorf teacher for a few years. The first time I walked into a Waldorf school, I just started crying and I didn't know why. And I realized, oh my God, this is human. This is human. These people are human and they're trying to teach humans. They're not behavioral mechanisms, right? And they're not, you know, some weird flaky godlike, they're just humans and they're entering into this and it's so beautiful. It just, how could that be bad? Now, whether it's true or not, I don't know, but it was so beautiful. Then you go to a Demeter biodynamic farm and you look at what's happening on the farm and how they're growing food and you taste that food, right? You know about biodynamics, right, Steiner and everything?
I don't, no. It's not as famous as the
Waldorf schools. I'm sorry if I'm assuming too much. Okay, Waldorf schools, they're the largest independent school system in the world.
Yeah, I didn't know that, first of all,
that's pretty staggering, right?
It is.
Okay. You know, I mean, it's difficult to quantify that carefully, but it's right up there, okay? So biodynamics, Steiner gave lectures in 1924 that talked about how humanity was killing the earth with pesticides and false nitrogens and other false chemicals that weren't living chemicals. And they were impregnating the earth with them, and they were creating these giant pest farms, which were these monocultural crops that are causing all the pests to come there, because that's not how you grow plants. You know, you don't put 5 square miles of wheat in the middle of the world. That's insane. So anyway, he goes in and he gives all these farmers a set of lectures and talks about homeopathically creating compost piles that will bring in the cosmic forces from the planets and from the sun and from the stars and configure that soil in a way that because you are now a human being harmonizing with the cosmos and the earth, you're going to create earth that's of a greater nutritive value than the earth itself can create.
Hmm.
Wow. Okay. That's one reason for spiritual science right there. And then you take that, you put it in. He talked about various preparations that you create, you know, but you put some manure in cow horns. Why? Well, the cow horn has a certain creation from the cosmos. It has forces in it. You stuff it full of fresh manure and you put it in the ground for a whole winter. And when you take it out, and we've done this, you get this fantastic smelling humus stuff that you then homeopathize into water and then spread on your plants at a certain time of the year. Etc., etc., etc. Okay. And you get a new agriculture, which is very popular in the world. Demeter products are all biodynamic products. You go to a marketplace in Spain on a Sunday morning and you'll see them. You'll see Demeter stands all over the place, especially in Europe. Okay. Germany for sure. Maybe not. I don't know Spain that well. So then, I mean, he does the architecture of the Gertianum. Astonishing, etc. So going back. So these were evidences to me that I wasn't just hearing an enlightened person per se, but I was hearing somebody that was an initiate that had taken on a mission on the earth and was beginning to transform the earth, was beginning to change human culture so that it wouldn't destroy anymore, and has done an amazingly good job of beginning that process. So again, I had this evidence that allowed me to stay with Steiner. Allowed me to remain and go, but look around, but everybody I look at, honestly, they don't touch him with a 10-foot pole, not even close, okay? So that's also a false statement by me because I can't find anybody who even touches him. Why? Sure, everybody's got beautiful words. Everybody's got beautiful ideas. Everybody can, you know, make a connection with me that's amazing, Jason, but show me, you know, I'm an American, show me. And man, he showed me in spades. Now what happens? Well, now you go to the writing. Now you go to the talks about the spiritual beings and the sun and Zarathustra. Oh, sure, that sounds nuts in a way, right? Obviously, to any mind, there's a craziness there. But then I got the evidence on the other side. And there's no way you come up with that stuff with a logical, mind. That's inspired. It's so obviously inspired. that you're struggling. So I'm in the, really, I call it working hypotheses, but maybe more honestly, you're just kind of struggling in the astonishment of what seems to have happened on the earth, of who this guy was. This is a big deal to me in a certain sense. If he really is that big a deal, he's a big, big deal. And it makes sense that our world pays no attention to him by and large at all, right? Look, the best kept secret in the 20th century, right?
Is very crucial to me. Maybe it's a crucial fiction, we'll see, but it's definitely a belief. Now we can put one on the table and examine it. I believe that there are almost no historical figures or figures of great influence that are really worthy of my admiration. Even though I'm impressed by them, right? Like, I've been very impressed by Dostoevsky, Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, I could make a big list, and then on to Castaneda. And what I've been doing since I turned 40 is sort of retroactively re-examining my gods and dethroning them, right? Showing them to be human, revealing their humanness to myself. And in the process, you know, I found more than I bargained for, like some very disturbing kind of elements there. Really just noticing how the culture that I've imbibed, the influences that I've allowed, you know, to influence me, have been severely compromised. So I've ended up with a belief, quite a strong belief, that what they say about Jesus, nothing good comes out of Bethlehem, or Nazareth, nothing good comes out of Nazareth, that nothing good comes out of this culture. So if I've heard of him, he must be untrustworthy. That's kind of where I'm at now, and I realize it's a very unnecessarily strong position, but sometimes I need, because I've been too impressionable, I've been too susceptible to influence, I've been looking for daddy everywhere, I've been looking for these guides and these teachers. So to the present at 53, I've got this belief that's like a bulwark against many other beliefs, which is just don't trust the hype. Don't believe in any of these gurus, and even though I'm working with somebody who calls himself enlightened, but we have a one-on-one relationship, so I can really test the goods constantly. That's very different from influences and teacher figures and inspirational figures that are long distance or dead. So with Steiner, to me, it's ironic, because when I start hearing how influential he was, I start feeling distrustful. And I tell you, there is some logic to that suspicious belief, which is, look at the world we've got. Look at it, right? It is the way it is because of all the cultural influences that have shaped it. So it's very hard for me to think that there could be somebody like Steiner who was so profoundly in tune and was able to be so effective at influencing. A part of it is sour grapes, because I would like to have that on my CV. I'd like to tick those boxes before I shuffle off this mortal coil and feel I left a legacy as apparently positive and amazing as Steiner. So part of it is I'm aware of that, but there also is some logic behind that. Like I've had a distrust of Waldorf schools, not because I distrust Steiner, on the contrary, but because they've been established. I just think the world we have now, I could say this Ahrimanic world, why would it allow such, something to take root like that? So, I mean, that's not a question, because that's an impossible question, but that's a response. I just wanted to really just respond that, and I noticed this today because I was tweeting my podcast and I was looking for Steiner at Twitter accounts. Yeah, hardly anyone's talking about Steiner, even though there are these schools. So it's very interesting. It's very interesting. I mean, maybe it's a possible redemption for me, or my a way for me to let go of a conviction that maybe it is possible to be a positive influence in this world, even through the culture, by being, well, I don't actually know. Maybe you can answer that. However Steiner did it, if he did it, because he certainly wasn't, he didn't hold back, did he? He must have worked his arse off to be effective. But he wasn't, he was able to do what he did, and so he was successful. But as you say, he's practically unknown, and yet you also said that he founded these different disciplines that are across the planet. So how does that even happen? Like, how come Steiner isn't famous?
You're great, man. I've done about 5-6 interviews over the years. Nothing touches this with a 10-foot pole. you're really, let me say, thank you very much, really.
Thank you. Welcome.
I just want to say, too, to un-rosy the picture that I gave, okay, is that I have seen Waldorf schools that started with just absolute astonishing richness and spiritual depth and love and caring and just truly amazing, okay? Mm-hmm. And then I've watched them as the decades have proceeded and seen that spirituality shrivel and become sclerotic and administrational powers taking over, and the old guard retiring and the new guard not having the same impulses, and the school becoming more and more, shall we say, perfunctory. Okay, having methods, but not having a depth of spirit that matters in the human realm. It doesn't matter in the behavioral realm, right? And so, you know, just to show you that that Aramonic power is there, but it's not going to fix, it's not going to destroy right away a lot of the times, right? Mm. It's just going to, it's going to work its way in. It's going to, you know, it's going to insinuate until it has achieved its goals. Right. So just to show you that it is a struggle. There's nothing victorious that's happened here by any means. And that's one side of it. Mm. The other side is that Steiner wrote as a scientist. He never cared. He never cared about, as it were, any kind of popularity thing or any kind of fad like energy coming off him. And in fact, he worried about it being such a problem because it was already a problem in his time. Right. Mm. So that we don't get beautiful ideas that just sensationalize our souls. Really, you get them, but you work a long time before they kind of work up because it's just a lot of hard work to study. It's like what a hard time learning calculus was for me. And then at a certain moment, when I got enough of a mastery of it, my soul was just flooded with joy at the power that gave me, the insights I could learn from it. You know what I mean? But I couldn't get that at the beginning. It was a lot of hard work. Mm. Steiner's very much like learning a calculus thing. It's all that hard work nobody wants to do. Who learns calculus? You know, here's the thing that changes the whole world. Well, how many people really know it? Not a lot, because it's so hard to learn, right? It's all that work that you have to do to get to the point where you go, aha, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you don't get there, you go, oh, this isn't making sense. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true. Or whatever we do, right? Mm-hmm. So that's my explanation. Steiner could have been popular as all get out, as it were. You know what I mean? I'm sure he could have been. But that was just an anathema to a truly spiritual person impregnating the world with a new spirituality that now, through the seed of his work, will change things over the course of millennia. And again, I sound like I'm contradicting myself in a certain sense here, right? So the battle's on, the struggle is on. We're becoming more and more aware that we're destroying the earth. It's still not in our heads, honest to God, and no matter how much of the words come out of our mouth, it's still not there, but it's happening, you know? The destruction of the world is getting more and more real until that tipping point where it's truly, truly a fact in the consciousness of humanity. And it's not yet. No matter what we see, it's just not what it is. We will change things. Okay, I'm done now.
Well, that, of course, that's a whole other thing, because I think that it, in a certain sense, it's too present in the consciousness of humanity, because there's this anti-human feeling now with Extinction Rebellion, whatever, that humans are the problem, and if we get rid of humans, so I think it's more a question of a truth again that's been distorted through misrepresentation or over, you know, a truth without tenderness kind of thing that deranges us. So I think we are more and more aware of how destructive society is, but we're becoming aware in a way that isn't helpful. So that, I just wanted to say that as a response to your last point. Now I want to rewind to what you were saying before, because I thought that was very, very interesting and compelling. I wanted to ask, I'll say my thought first and then I'll ask my question. What you're describing, the way Steiner wasn't, that he didn't offer these wonderful, blissful soul experiences. Remind me of something David Shana said, but I'll have to bookmark that. That's the opposite of what Steiner said about Ahriman, that Ahriman, when he comes, he's going to offer that. He's going to lure human beings in with that they can have these big, wonderful experiences of clairvoyance and visions and stuff for nothing without the work, and that's how he's going to snare them. So it's where I just thought,
each one will have a different experiences, right? So each one will be having different experiences,
right.
Just so to throw that in.
So that's happening already. You see, with the identity politics now, where you can name your pronoun, you can name everything. Basically, you just be a universe unto yourself. You've got your own set of pronouns, your own set of protocol. Everybody else has to bow down to it. But yeah, all these little isolate bubbles of consciousness where super specialness, you get to feel super special and super endowed, you know. I think that we're seeing that, the beginnings of that. So yeah, I wanted to ask about Steiner, how many people did he talk to in his lectures on average, would you say?
That's interesting. I think at the beginning, when we see some of the early lecture cycles, there were maybe 10 or 12 people in the room.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you know, by the time the Gurdjieffianum had been built, you know, there'd be 500, 600, maybe 1,000, and maybe more than that.
Wow.
If it was a special conference. And then in 1922-23, the Wolf Agency of Germany, I believe they were called the Wolf Agency, organized his tour of lectures. And at those, there would always be 3,000 or so people in the auditorium and people standing outside trying to get in.
Wow.
And then it was then that Steiner gave his lectures in the driest, most prosaic way you could possibly imagine. Okay. And this is very notably mentioned by people who knew him well. And then the brown shirts started really going after the situation, beating up people outside, and Steiner couldn't continue the tour and had to go back to Switzerland and could really never enter Germany again.
There were brown shirts in the early 20s.
Sure. Oh yeah. Yeah. 23 was when was the putsch in Munich that Hitler did.
Really, was that early on? I always think of Hitler starting in 33.
Right. That's when he got an official position in the government.
But he was going for 10 years.
You know, he started maybe 21, 22. Well, even earlier, maybe you know, after the war. Once he got into that group, you know, he built his stuff. But by 23, they did the putsch in. I believe I've got the date right, don't I, Jason? I think I do.
Don't
1923
know.
Was the Munich putsch where they tried to take over. He got shot. He got arrested. He had to spend, how long did he, you know, yeah, 7-year sentence. I think he spent 18 months in the Langsberg prison, as it were, before he got out again. And then he changed his whole tactic. And instead of going after it through revolution, he went at it through taking over the parliament,
right,
by increasing the Nazi party's influence in the parliament. And that took a long time.
Yeah, no, I didn't realize. So that's an interesting data point.
He specifically mentioned Steiner and Anthroposophy, sir, and was very much against them.
Yeah,
in his talks, right in front of a lot of people.
Oh, Hitler really?
Hated him with passion.
Wow.
Yes. Everything was outlawed. Everything anthroposophical was outlawed when Hitler took over power. Everything, biodynamics, at Waldorf schools, the Christian community, which is a whole other thing, eurythmy, all the, you know, there's a whole bunch of things we haven't talked about Steiner created. We've only scratched the surface of the institutions, anthroposophical medicine, right? There's maybe 10,000 doctors in the world that are anthroposophical doctors. He gave a couple hundred lectures on medicine.
Mm. Would you say that today in 2020, Steiner is most known and respected in Christian community or not?
No.
Because that was how
in the Christian world, the work is done. It ended with the Book of Revelation. Nobody can add anything to that, really. They can extrapolate from it. They can't add anything to it. Steiner adds a lot.
But when I searched for your name, the first sites that came up were Christian sites.
So there's what happened in 1920 or so, I don't remember the exact date, but a bunch of theologians came to Steiner and said, you know, we really think that ritual and that the Christian, you know, orientation is still relevant. And yet we don't see it working in the Catholic churches. That's all decadent. Mm-hmm. And we don't see it in the Protestant churches. And is there value in ritual? And he said, there really still is. And they said, well, could you help us? Yeah. He said, well, I'll help you, but I'm not going to found this. My work is anthroposophy, spiritual science, blah, blah, blah. But I'll help you. So then he turns around and gives them, you know, 50 or 70 lectures that astounded the PhDs in theology that were there. Nobody had a clue. He knew word one about any of this stuff. And it was just this encyclopedia somebody opened, right? So he gives them this whole picture in the context of the evolution of consciousness of what religion does throughout history, okay? In its positive non-decadent forms, because every religion eventually becomes decadent. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones we end up knowing about. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives us our sour impression of them. In their heyday, they weren't that way, arguably. So then out of that, then in 1990, actually it's going to be the 100th anniversary this year, on September 16th, 1920, they founded a new priesthood that it was the first Christian church in history to ordain women fully as priests. And they took the seven sacraments that come from the mystery schools, not from Catholicism. And Steiner rewrote the liturgy and established what's known as the Christian Community, the Movement for Religious Renewal, which is now all over the world. And in about 1993, 1994, we were at a little meeting, the general meeting at our church. I've gone to the Christian Community for years just because I get to hear Steiner, right? Steiner's words, even though they're very similar to the Catholic Mass, okay? Mm-hmm. And in Steiner's work, he says, well, of course, you never celebrate the Eucharist. You only celebrate the Eucharist when the sun is ascending. You never celebrate it after the sun is eating. This has to do with our connection to the cosmos kind of thing, right? That he perceived directly, arguably. Mm-hmm. So our priest was there one day. He had this smile on his face, and he was giving the talk. And so he said, "Why are you smiling today? What's going on?" He says, "During the last months, the Christian community has grown to the point around the world where, with the rotation of the earth and the sun rising, the act of consecration of man, and that's what the Eucharist is called in the Christian community, the act of consecration of man is now celebrated continuously all the way around the earth." And this gave this guy this kind of joy, because what a beautiful picture that it couldn't happen until it had grown to the point where it could happen, right? It's just this kind of organic reality, right? So anyway, so there's a seminary in Stuttgart. That's the oldest one. There's a seminary here in Toronto. There was a seminary in Toronto, but it just moved there from Spring Valley, New York. And I think maybe the Hamburg still has a seminary. So they've been around 100 years now. And they're not, you know, they have anthroposophy as one of the foundations of their understanding as a theological community.
Right.
But they're not anthroposophy. You really aren't. If you walk in there, you know, it's its own thing. I love it.
You know,
it's very, very, very austere.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's interesting, that word, because my wife loves that word. And what the reason I'm in Spain is that, well, we're moving here. I've moved here, but our project, our vision is to create a secular monastery of sorts, a retreat where we can live a simple, austere life without Netflix eventually, and probably without Zoom as well, and obviously learn to work the land and whatnot, and provide a space for others, you know, like a monastic kind of community. I mean, the word monastic has different meanings for different people, and some people find it off-putting, but my wife and I both have an affinity for that word and for that lifestyle.
I wish you well, man. I really, really do. The world needs that so bad. Yeah. I really, really wish you well.
Thank you. Yeah, I was going to say, while you're talking about all that, that it's a good sign that I don't even know how to pronounce anthroposophy, right? I find it very hard to pronounce.
That works, because
you don't hear it. Like, there is no anthroposophical movement post-Steiner. There are ways, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, there are ways in which he is influenced greatly and inspired, and these different areas, you say you haven't mentioned all of them, yeah, but and many of them, maybe most, maybe even all of them, are to do with the mundane and practical stuff. I mean, education isn't really mundane, but it's certainly worldly. They're practical stuff. But he hasn't created a religion. It has, and it's certainly not like theosophy. Like, I'm very distrustful of theosophy because I can see how it's informed the New Age movement, and from there to all kinds of other stuff. I can see it as so many of the seeds of theosophy have grown into, I would say, toxic ivy that's just kind of strangling a lot of our consciousness. Like, I don't see it as an evolutionary belief system. That's my feeling about theosophy, and it was very influential, is my point anyway. Whereas anthroposophy, why can't I pronounce it? It just seems like a word that's not supposed to be said. I never hear about it.
It does feel that way, doesn't it? Yeah, anthroposophy.
Yeah, anthroposophy.
You know, Steiner was the director of the Theosophical Society, right? You know that.
No, I didn't.
He was the director of the German section.
Right.
Okay. So people say, oh, Steiner was just a theosophist, blah, blah, blah. But when Steiner was asked to become the director, when a very small 300 people, maybe in the entire German section in 1902, he said, well, I'll do it, because these are the only people that could hear what he was saying, right? When he finally started talking about esoteric things, for heaven's sake, the regular guy wasn't going to hear a word, right? So he knew this was his population, but he's very clear at the beginning and said, I will only speak out of my own spiritual research. I will not be referencing Blavatsky or Sinnott or Alcott or any of these people. Mm-hmm. So that's important to know about him. So he really was in the Theosophical Society, but he was never a theosophist. Right. Even though one of his books is titled Theosophy.
Right. Yeah.
But if you read it, you know, you'll see that it has nothing to do with any theosophical stuff. But that was his that was the karma, right? That was the situation he found himself in, where for the first time in 1900, he could actually, at the Count Brockdorf group, which is a theosophical group, and I believe it was Berlin, he could speak out of the depths of the spiritual research that he'd been, you know, doing for quite a while.
Yeah.
Could never speak to anybody about. Sorry to interrupt.
That's all right.
Yes, and I totally agree with you about theosophy. Frightfully toxic. Steiner gave a set of lectures, sir, called The Occult Movement in the 19th Century.
Yeah.
And in there, he describes the life of Blavatsky, why the masters felt that they needed to bring somebody like Blavatsky into human evolution, because Ahriman's power was becoming so great. But then how it went awry, how he says she was at a moment occultly imprisoned. So that she saw in a distorted way and didn't know that she was.
Right. So that's back
to the... Et cetera, et cetera. Now you get all this
stuff. Yeah, back to the clairvoyance thing, and you know, what I was running about Steiner as well, how aware he was of that possibility. I was going to say something else. You know, at a more ground level, because I've been an occultist myself and a writer of occult books and stuff, I'm quite familiar with a lot of different independent or apparently independent occult researchers and writers and practitioners. And I certainly, you know, everyone in that field, in this field, has heard of Steiner. But I don't think I've met, I have one friend, and she's definitely not an occultist, who's very influenced by Steiner. I haven't noticed Steiner's influence in that area, is what I'm trying to say. Whereas Crowley, he's everywhere, as you know. Blavatsky, maybe not by name. People don't necessarily talk about her, and it's not obvious, but Blavatsky, as I say, her ideas and her system and those two massive books, there's no doubt that you can see the influence of those beliefs in the field of occultism in general. It seems to me that Steiner it's not that he's persona non grata. People know who he is, and I imagine that they respect him to whatever degree, but I don't think they're very interested in him, is my impression. And I'm generalizing here, but just to make a point or raise a question. And I wonder, I think it has to do with the way that he presented his knowledge. It's quite off-putting. It's what you were saying earlier.
Yes.
It's demanding. It's taxing. Like even just doing this podcast, whew, that was a lot of work. I had to listen over and over again, not over and over, but several times to things he said to actually have a response. Because they don't fit easily into the existing internal, you know, mental structures that I have, and I presume other people's either. They're not user-friendly. He's not user-friendly, is he? So that's, I mean, that's...
In what his, science is.
To his credit.
Yeah, what science is. Yeah, may I say that? What science is really user-friendly? Every science that there is requires an enormous amount of human effort to bring about a cogent, coherent picture of understanding through that modality, through that paradigm. Right. And then even each one of those reveals the world. Right. Physics reveals its own world. Chemistry reveals its own world. Biology reveals its own world. Spiritual science reveals its own world eventually. So the argument would be said.
Mm-hmm.
And who wants to do science? Really? I mean, here, you know, I want to go back to something because you said, yeah, we religiousize science. I didn't mean that. I meant that because of the modality of the consciousness we're in, the way that science forms concepts are automatically obvious to us. Now, there are people who fetishize science into a religion. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about existentially. You and I have a relationship to science that we can't help but have. That has nothing to do with taking it on and in a higher form. It is the religion, as I mean this word in a very special way, of our time. We simply know it to be true. We don't even spend time believing it. In the past, in Hinduism, at a certain point in its history, people didn't believe in those gods, Steiner argues. They had absolute immediate knowing of them and didn't have to believe.
Right.
This is the difference.
I see. So yeah,
I'm sorry I'm so insistent on it.
You're talking about...
See what I'm saying?
You're talking about the science.
Ours will be a religion. They'll say, oh, those people believed in science 1,000 years from now. Right.
And they won't be wrong,
well,
because
we didn't believe in
because
it.
We're in the decadent phase of science now, I would say.
And we are in the decadent phase of it, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's where, that's why spiritual science came. It's because it needed to add the demand of us that the rest of our organs of perception be awakened so we could get the... Because science has been a benefit to us. Science has tempered the soul. Science has allowed the concept of invisible forces to be understood. Science has given us a formation of concepts that's so rigorous that we can bring content of the spiritual world to us in a way that does not overpower our souls, that does not sway us. But we can think about them. And that's why you like Steiner, by the way. I'm sorry, I'm telling you stuff. I'm having fun, right? Right? That's why. Because you know that's, I see. This is geometry. Geometry, can you influence me with geometry? I have to work at it, but once I get it, man, I got something really pretty amazing, right? And that's where it's at. I'm having too much fun. Tell your people I'm having too much fun. I apologize.
They can probably tell. I'm going to counter your imposing your reality on me, man. I'm going to counter as to
That's
why.
Right. I'm sorry.
Why I like Steiner, because you made me think about it. Currently, anyway, why I like Steiner, why I feel I'm thriving on the material that you've made available to all of us, is that it's deepening my sense of, I could say destiny. I was going to say destiny there because it just popped into my head. My sense of being connected my sense of being embedded in deeper layers of consciousness, and my sense of responsibility, and my sense of possibility. But what I'm trying to say here, because those are all a bit vague, is that it's very essential to me, I think to all of us, to become more viscerally aware of how we are connected, not just to each other, but to those who came before us. And yes, maybe that goes to Angeli and Archangeli and Archai, and I don't doubt it actually, but that means I believe it. So then I doubt it when I recognize, wait, there's a belief in there. But you know, I do feel that the sensations or the viscera incorporate eternal beings. But that's it in a nutshell. Like, for me to tune in more to what I am and why I'm here and what I have to do, that's all I'm looking for, you know? And it's Steiner, yeah, I mean that is so that's so unusual, you know, for me to find that is somebody who died 100 years ago. Well, not quite, is it, but a long time ago. And through your work as well, you know, when I listen to the audios, I have to remind myself it's not Steiner speaking. No, Steiner didn't speak German. That can't be Steiner. There's something about, and I'll have to hear his voice to see if this is, you know, if there's anything in this. But it seems to me there's something that you've tuned into. Because I don't like audiobooks. And the reason I don't like audiobooks is because the person reading never seems to even remotely correspond with the person who wrote the book. And even when I read my own book, I felt I didn't get it right. But my experience listening to you reading Steiner is that you're very in tune with the material. So I feel as though I'm actually listening to Steiner reading them.
Well, thank you. Have you ever read them out loud yourself?
No.
Well, I would recommend it, because I don't think I'm doing anything really honestly that's very extraordinary. What happens when you read Steiner is that the flow of his thinking, regardless of translation, becomes something that has substance. It just has a substance, and you're carried up into it. I'm not saying I get all flighty, though there are places, frankly, I did not like my tone in that recording at all. There were times when you know, my tone was funny, or the writing was so overwhelming that I was taken up too much. But generally you're taken up. There's a sacredness, there's a holiness in it. That's not a commonplace understanding of that word, okay? It's so unadorned, it's so, what's the darn word? Unsentimental, right? It's so it's a holiness without sentimentality, which is probably hard to imagine in our time, right? Given Lucifer's domain, right? But it does, and you just, and you know, when I first had the sight, I really didn't want to be put forth at all. So I didn't have my name on it at all. And I got fairly nasty emails from people saying, Steiner never talked in English, and there's no recordings of, you know, you're lying, kind of thing, you know. And I felt I had to actually put my name on there, read and recorded by Dale Brunsvold, because I had to do it, you know. And I'm just a guy reading a book. That's all I am, right? Why does that matter? Thank you for having me on.
No, well,
but you know, I'm just a guy reading a book. for heaven's sake.
Sure, true. Yeah, but if anyone's going to internalize Steiner's writings, is they're actually speakings, mostly transcripts, it would be the guy who spent hundreds, thousands of hours reading them. So that was my reasoning there.
Well, I'll tell you, I could recommend people to you to have on Dennis Klocek,
okay.
Art Zients, and they, if they would be on, and those guys, to me, are amazing. Okay, they're working anthroposophists.
Right. All right. Okay, just definitely. So you know. I'll follow that up. I want to disagree though with you that saying that you're just a guy reading the book, because you're very different actually in person. Like the persona that comes through on those audios, I don't think I even realized you were American. I think I kind of sort of half thought you were British, because you had this so reserved kind of formal, can't really find the word for it, austere maybe, but in fact in person you're exuberant and full of energy, and so clearly you were tuning in to some different part of yourself to read those books. So it's more than just reading that's happening, I think.
I'll tell you in particular, Jason, when I read the Manus Symphony of the Creative Word, Manus Symphony of the Creative Word, those lectures, there were places in there where he's talking about butterflies and how butterflies work, and in terms of what he called spiritual forces and spiritual substance and all these things. They're flabbergasting lectures, okay? And there's places that got so beautiful. And he was like a scientist talking about X equals Y, right? But the pictures that came into your head were so gorgeous, and you had no idea they were coming, that I would find myself bursting into tears. And I didn't even know why. I didn't even know what had happened. And I'd have to stop and rewind, you know, and read that over again now that I was composed. Mm. Just to give you a picture of sometimes that could happen with this guy. Amazing, really. Mm. So, you know, there's that too. You know, the first Gratianum was burned down. You ever hear about that?
Mm, I did hear, yeah.
Yeah, and that would happen, you know, that happened on New Year's Eve of 1922, and then it continued until, you know, January 1st of 1923. So right in that night, this astonishing building was burned to the ground. And I mean astonishing building, man. Take a look at that sometime. You want to get your mind blown.
So that, you know, was
10 stories high, roughly, 9 stories high. Well, they don't know for sure. There was an arsonist, and I believe he was found in the burning, that he died in the burning. And I don't know what his motivation was. Was it, you know, was it the brown shirts? Was it the Nazi movement or the whole fascism movement that was starting to, right, cover Europe at that time? Yeah, that sounds familiar. And then, right, or was it some people think, well, maybe it was a disgruntled Catholic who was very upset. And it could have been that, you know, who was mentally, had mental difficulties. But, you know, nobody knows a fixed answer, you know, to that. But a massive tragedy, something that, so when I looked at the Gratianum in my life, the first Gratianum, I've always been strangely moved by it. Like I could have been there. You know, if I ever had any kind of past life thing, it still hurts when I think about it. Why would that be? Mm. You know, yeah. Beautiful building, or unusual building, let's say. You know, so it had two, it had a round, big round dome, and then a smaller dome that was attached to it in the back, almost like a pregnant woman from a profile kind of thing, right? And that's what the top of that looked like. Nobody'd ever made a building like that. So you had this big dome and a smaller dome, wedded, right? And every square inch of the inside of it was touched by human hands, had been carved. It was all wood. So they carved everything, the walls all the way up to the sides.
That's interesting. Cause
okay, I'm rambling. Sorry, go ahead.
The last house I had in Canada, which is up for sale now, needed such heavy renovation that by the end of it, it was a crack house when we bought it.
Wow.
So it wasn't just renovation, it was cleansing, obviously, cleaning. And by the end of it, I felt like I touched every part of that house. It's not literally true, but I had that feeling, and I just felt how important that was, that I'd got, like, getting to know a woman's body, but to be very romantic there, maybe a bit Luciferian sensual, but it was like that. Like I had a relationship with the house that I lived in that I'd never had before because of that intimacy of touch, you know, and that comprehensibility of touch, comprehensiveness.
Let's add, you go to that again. Let's talk about this a little bit. So we have Ahriman, and we have his forces in our soul, and we have Lucifer, and we have his forces in our soul. So how is it that, in a sense, I mean, we have them. If we didn't have them, we couldn't do the human thing. I'll go that far. We couldn't do the human thing. So how do we use them, even honor them, but at the same time, you know, keep them in their place as part of who we are as human beings?
Yeah, well, it seems to be a struggle.
So when you touch that stuff and the sensuality is there, I can see that it only positively, given the intentions of what you're creating, right? There's nothing negative there to me at all. You say it almost, and maybe I read too much into what you said, but it's almost like you were saddened that, well, I had to use it. No, you know, to me, that's no, your intention was Christ's intention, shall I say. And there you are using the Luciferic awareness to deepen what's going on, to very much bless in some ways, because the Christ can work through that. That's my opinion. I don't know that for sure.
And that's a good point. And the Ahrimanic was there too, because I was angry a lot of the time when I was doing renovations. And of course, there was a lot of destruction involved. Literally, you have to destroy the place to rebuild it. So in fact, that the sensuous Lucifer thing is relatively benign, absolutely, compared to some of the destructive energy and the rage that I put into it. But that also had its place. I wouldn't have got it done if I hadn't had that energy of destruction.
Yeah.
So all the parts,
I still think you're living back in that Crowley.
Sorry, say
I just
that again.
Wanted to say.
You have to say it again, I'm afraid, because you broke up.
I said I was saying it somewhat facetiously, that you're when you mentioned Lucifer, I could almost hear it was from the Crowley time that your experiences, rather than, let's say, with the Christ in the center, living in the polarity of these things that are simply realities in our soul.
Yeah. It was a power trip. And that was very central to these years in Canada, with the renovating the house and then running a thrift store, was just dealing directly. I actually say this, obey the law of matter. That's Satan's realm. I guess that's more Ahriman than Lucifer. But it's so humbling. I just had to keep bowing to the will of matter. Taking people's junk in the thrift store, dealing with hammers and nails and saws and wood and... And yes, I was raging against it, because my idea of channeling Lucifer or Satan was being king of the world. Of course, that's how he gets you, right? In fact, it's shit work. But it's good work. I mean, shit work is good work. It does good. It restores things and it redeems them. I wanted to ask you a final question that might be a bit of a bum note to end on, but I really wanted to get to it, because you were, I think you were kind of hinting at what's going on in the world now a few moments back. What do you think about that excerpt that I put on YouTube about Steiner talking about the vaccine, and in the context of today, do you feel that he was referring to what's happening now with COVID and the vaccination?
Well, first of all, I'll say that, you know, it would be just speculation, you know what I mean? And I don't know, when it comes to things in the world, I'm not much of a speculator. I don't spend a lot of time imagining what secret societies are doing behind the scenes. If they are, I'm never going to know anyway. So why would I fill my head with, something unverifiable? And I wonder what that is. If is that an Ahrimanic delusion or a Luciferic illusion? I'm not sure. But yes, he did mention, and in a contemplative kind of speculative way, he talked about that probably in the future sometime, they were going to have a vaccine. And in my reading of it, he meant that they would probably give to children when they're newly born, and that it would somehow be able to make the thinking of spiritual thoughts impossible. That they would just become so maybe mineralized in their consciousness that the idea of the spiritual world would just never be a possibility. Okay, you know, okay, he said, but he never said that I've ever found that vaccines as such are something that you fanatically stay away from.
Sure, that's a whole other. He never said that.
Don't be fanatical.
Yeah, yeah. No, we don't want to get pulled into that trap because that's the whole schismogenesis.
Yeah. So I've never been a vaccine person. I don't do them. I mean, if I were to get sick from illnesses, I would probably take vaccines, but I don't get sick. I've never had a flu shot because I don't get sick from the flu. Mm-hmm. So why would I fix something that's not broken?
Right.
You know what I mean? So, but I have no dogma in my head saying I would never have a vaccine. And this one's pretty severe. So I am thinking pretty hard about what's going to happen. I probably will need to take this one just to make my loved ones safe, you know, that kind of thing. Oh. That's kind of where I am. But there's a lot of people in the anthroposophical world who are just adamant about some conspiracy going on, blah, blah, blah. And I just, fine, it could be true. But nobody's ever going to know, and I just don't spend my energy in that direction. I never have. Data is data.
You're talking to the wrong guy then, if you want to stay in that particular tunnel, because I would counter, and I did say this might be a bum note to end on, but what
it's
the
okay,
hell? We can talk again anyway. I would counter that many of the things you talked about, that you like these stories, it's Christ and the two Jesuses and that stuff, you also can't verify those, but you're okay with taking those on. So then why not take on the thing you can't verify, which is actually easier to verify? I mean, I can send you the stuff if you want, but clearly you probably don't. But in terms of the being forces of darkness, as spirits of darkness, as Steiner referred to them, working day and night in our world in a way that's becoming more and more observable socio-politically and through the technology and through the medicine as well.
Yeah, that's true.
There is a whole, you know, there's boatloads of evidence about this. Now, of course, you can't verify it. We can't really verify anything in the end except our inner world. I think we can go into that, and that's where reality is, in my opinion. So also, this is all Maya as well, but yeah, I wouldn't suggest you take the vaccine. I would suggest you get more informed about it, and particularly not for your loved ones, because I think there's the element of consent as well. You know, even if the physical effects aren't what they could be, consenting to a false narrative or possibly false narrative and a false solution. This is very much, I think, how the Ahrimanic force is working now. I think it's creating false problems and then it's offering these false magical solutions.
Well, that's an interesting picture. That really is. Well said. It is. But what about, let's say this, what about pandemics throughout the millennia? What do we say about those? They happen all the time all over the world and in certain places, right? And then we get a, you know, some kind of vaccine, Ebola. I'm not a vaccine rat, honestly, but you know, this happened all the time, but because it happened in the West, all of a sudden it's a different kind of a deal, it seems. Or are all these other people controlled or somehow distorted now because of the vaccines they've had in the Ebola regions? And I mean, is that all?
I think we're pretty far
been accomplished and we're the last remaining bastion.
I think we're pretty far along in terms of the psychic colonization of the species.
I don't know what that means.
Well, the Ahrimanic consciousness, I suppose, but it's manifesting through technology and through everything. But we can see the acceleration of consciousness in a certain sense, in a certain direction, through technology and through modern medicine.
Absolutely.
Obviously, modern medicine's transformed the world. So yeah, I'd say we're very far advanced in terms of believing things that are not real. let's put it just in that most simple way, and becoming less and less embodied. And if you're not embodied, you don't even care that you're spending your whole time swiping your cell phone, because and becoming less and less embodied for doing it, because you don't notice. It's that you're all in this conceptual realm, and you don't care if you take a vaccine or not, as long as you've got the freedom to do what you want to do. Like, we don't, and transgender is another key, you know, whatever core example of this, that if you don't like the way your body is, you just chop bits off and stick drugs in it, you know, to reify the ego, the false identity. There's a legion of examples, I think, in the way that we're becoming more and more estranged from our own bodies, which are the transmitting rod of what's real. Like, if we're, and this is what I love about Steiner, we can't connect to the spiritual realities except by fully connecting to the physical and the material and the internal organs and everything. That's our only route, right? So in terms of a pandemic, I don't see any evidence for a pandemic. I see a lot of evidence for mass swaths of propaganda pushing the narrative about a pandemic, and then present, and then, you know, pushing the solution, and stripping away our freedoms. I don't think you have to be paranoid to have that point of view. I'm suspicious of conspiracy narratives because they oversimplify, and they serve the different purpose, the same purposes from a different angle. I think often, but. Certainly, if you start with not believing what the mainstream media is telling you, then either you go and find other information to, you know, to back up your refusal to just succumb to the propaganda, or you just back away completely. And I think that that's getting harder and harder, to back away completely. Like, if you can't even travel anymore or leave your house without right. the mark of the beast in your forehead, figuratively uh-huh. but possibly literally too now, then I think we probably do have to get more informed. Even if it's just to communicate, like you're saying, with your loved ones. Well, if they're your loved ones, then they wouldn't want you to do something that would be harmful to yourself and would compromise your own integrity just to placate them. Like, that's not love.
So what are you seeing the vaccine accomplishing in this nefarious scenario? What could it be accomplishing in us?
Well, what I've read, and I haven't researched this, so I picked this, my wife researches more than I do, okay. But I've had it confirmed by other people, and I've looked into it a little bit. At least one of the vaccines is supposed to work by altering our DNA. So it's going in a level of DNA and reconfiguring our DNA. Now, if anything was going to serve a function of, like Steiner was talking about, it would be something that would attack our DNA, I would think. Wouldn't you think? Like, the basis of life itself.
Sure, that makes sense.
Right. And even, I mean, my God, even if somebody was dumb enough to say, well, we can trust our government, they wouldn't do anything bad. I mean, I don't know if anyone's dumb enough to say that in today's world. The fact that millions of people now are currently willing to take something into their body that will alter their DNA, knowing nothing about it, untested, just because the government says that they should, and that they want to be able to be free to do what they want to be to do, if that's not an Ahrimanic trap, I don't know what one would look like. You know, and I'm not, you know, I'm not paranoid. I really don't feel yeah. I am. I'm very happy in my life, and I love moving through this world. I think it's a beautiful world. Well, kind of. I mean, it's a beautiful planet. But I see these things. I see them. I mean, I'm an anomaly in this regard. I see things that for most people it would make them deranged with paranoia or furious. And I just say, well, that's the nature of the beast. That's the world we're in.
And I'm in a number of Facebook anthroposophical groups, and that is the norm, what you're describing.
Wow, that's interesting.
Everybody pretty much agrees in that way. And I don't disagree or agree. I just, oh, interesting. You know, that's my situation still, you know. And I just try to make sense of things. And yeah, so I honestly, you know, I'm enjoying hearing what you're saying. You know, what's been nice is that you brought it up at the end, and I have a lot of trust in you, and I've enjoyed your mind. And so as you share something, I can invest myself in listening more easily than if it was just somebody blasting away at the beginning of a YouTube channel.
Well, sure. You know what I mean? yeah. And
that works out nice for me.
I was cautious about bringing it up, not for that reason specifically, but because these things are, it's a minefield, you know, of belief.
Yeah. And, divisive even. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's encouraging what you said about the anthropods, because, I'd fit right in, at least on that level.
Very much so, actually. Yeah. And you might even have something to share with them that they don't have. So, you know, there's about three or four of them I'm in, you know, so.
Oh,
but you're probably not on Facebook. What am I thinking?
Well, no, I certainly try not to be. I got, you know, something for purely business purposes, but I definitely try not to use it. It's too bad if that's where they hang out, but maybe I can lure them over to the dark side.
they may have other groups or something. But I just love to write anthroposophical ideas, and all my posts are always long. and then I go back and I read it over and over before I send it out, and it's just a joy to kind of go, did I say that right? Did I, you know? And you're a writer, so you know, kind of know what I mean. That I can kind of say it the way I want to say it before I send it out, and so I try to use it really as our form of writing letters in our time.
But you know,
some kind of snippy, snappy, back and forthy.
That everything
correspondence.
Everything you write on Facebook no longer belongs to you; it belongs to Facebook. And it's being sent to all the corporations to put crunch into their AI thing so that they can better market to us.
That's the bad side.
And it's going to the intelligence agencies, right? So your life force, your psychic energy, your creativity, it's all going into this Aramanic intelligence. Sorry to be a bummer.
That's a good thing to think about. Yeah, you got me there, man.
And worst of all, you're making Facebook a more interesting place. So it keeps other people there as well.
Do we need to sacrifice ourselves and go to the belly of the beast and fight him there? I don't know.
You said
I don't want to be egotistic on that.
Definitely. One doesn't want to get turned into Don Quixote in the end times. But you did say something about battling. Right. Well, let's wind up for today anyway, because I used to keep it to 2 hours, but I couldn't today because we had too many things to get into. And I'm glad you brought up Ahriman at the end, because that certainly is something we could talk a lot about. But perhaps
anytime, sir. I'm having a blast. Anytime you want to gab, that's fun for me.
Okay.
I appreciate it very much.
Perhaps we can do it again sometime. And I'm going to continue cannibalizing your material and recycling it into my own, as long as it's inspiring me and as long as my listeners don't, you know.
Please send me links to those. Honestly, it was very fun. I was actually fast forwarding through my reading so I could hear your next comments. Honest to God, I was. I'm not trying to flatter you, man. But
no.
I enjoy your mind very much. I really, really enjoy your mind.
Thanks.
I told my wife. You know, when he speaks at a certain, a little bit slower than normal speed. And I almost feel like he keeps his thinking life and his speaking life completely in harmony. So all of a sudden a thought comes out of your mouth and I can tell you're like, wow, I like that. So that you're just living between thinking and speaking in a way that allows the creative, the spiritual to just rise up like revelatory almost. Honestly, it was really fun. I was like, I'm watching this guy think when I'm listening to his voice. Dale doesn't do that.
Time slips by. You think it's yours to sell.
that's the end of that conversation with Dale. If you want to listen to any of the very many Rudolf Steiner audio recordings that Dale has made, you click on the link in the show notes. Next week's podcast, I haven't done it yet, but I'm hoping it will be a continuation of last week's podcast, the reading, responding to Rudy Steiner.